Blog Talk Radio.
Telephone bill and utilities, so I can continue to search for employment.
To make matters worse, now with mounting debt and no income for unemployment benefits, my son's college education is in jeopardy. My heart is broken thinking that too many of the people we elect to serve and represent us could so callously turn their backs on their own constituents, people who are suffering through no fault of their own. This behavior is reprehensible, and it's time for it to stop. Enough is enough. Good luck with getting this to stop.
Yeah. A recent report from the President's Council of Economic Advisors noted that the failure to extend the benefits not only hurts the workers who have lost benefits, but also a drag on the economy, and is projected to kill 240,000 jobs in 2014 if the extension isn't renewed. An interesting thing, I think we talked about it last night, I'm not sure, but for every dollar spent on unemployment benefits,
mm-hmm.
the economy gains $1.56.
Yes, we did. There was a chart. Mm-hmm.
There's a chart. That's what it generates. It's a tremendously important thing. The National Labor Relationship. NLRB.
National Labor Relations
Union
Board.
Election rule.
Today issued a proposed rule that would alleviate the delays, inefficiencies, abusive process, and unnecessary litigation that plagued the current system for workers who want to vote on whether to have a union. AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka said, what did he say? The National Labor Relations Board, let's see, we read it.
Says, when workers petition for an NLRB election, they should receive a timely opportunity to vote. But the current NLRB election process is riddled with delay and provides too many opportunities for employers to manipulate and drag out the process through costly and unnecessary litigation and denies workers a vote.
Mm-hmm.
The new rule would
allow for electronic filing and transmission of election petitions and other documents, ensure that employees, employers, and unions receive and exchange timely information they need to understand and participate in the representation case process, streamline pre- and post-election procedures to facilitate agreement and eliminate unnecessary litigation, include telephone numbers, email addresses, and voter lists to enable parties to the election to be able to communicate with voters using modern technology, and consolidate all election-related appeals to the board into a single post-election appeals process.
NLRB Chairman Mark Pierce said, unnecessary delay and inefficiencies hurt both employees and employers. These proposals are intended to improve the process for all parties in all cases, whether non-union employees are seeking a union to represent them or unionized employees are seeking to decertify a union.
A similar election rule was issued in 2011 and due to go in effect in April of 2012, but the business community mounted a successful legal battle to block its implementation.
Fine. We did some more stuff I wanted to talk about tonight. Not so much news.
We had to get to that Pacific Rim.
Well, we'll do that in just a few minutes. I wanted to go to this.
Trans-Pacific.
That just takes a second to get this stuff in. Amazing. Michelle Bachmann, those of you who may know who she is,
mm-hmm.
said if English was good enough for Jesus when he wrote the Bible, it should be good enough for Coke. Okay, I guess that's Coke, C-O-K-E. I don't know what that means. Are there any drugs being used in government? Yes. Here is the dope to prove it. Michelle Bachmann. Bill de Blasio, the new mayor of New York City, said, if we're subsidizing companies, we have every right to demand a living wage for the people they pay. I agree with him 100% on that, totally 100%. All right. But I wanted to get to, Jamie Dimon.
The next one. Right there. I am Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan. I just got a 74% pay raise, even though under my watch we paid $20 billion in fines for wrongdoing. My $20 million salary means I made $9,615 an hour. So I make more in 2 hours than a minimum wage worker will make from a whole year of honest, hard work. Does that seem fair?
So, Jamie Dimon, up your butt. Okay. Now, let's go. I want to go back up here because I want to listen from asking you this. State pension obligations can be crushing, but corporate welfare costs more. Right?
Of course it does.
Yeah. And this is from AFSCME Union. And, hang on a second. I'm coming up. It will come. It will come. A little later. Washington Post. When Louise Jordan walked through the doors of Abraham Lincoln High School in North Philadelphia 34 years ago, after landing her dream job as a special education teacher, right out of college, she didn't worry about her tiny salary, just $10,770 per year back then. It wasn't a lot to live on, but it sure kept contributing
But if she kept contributing 7.5% of every paycheck into Pennsylvania's pension fund, the state would support her when the time came to retire. The expectations were crystal clear, Jordan said. You kind of took for granted that the state would fulfill its obligations. For a teacher with a long career of service, the funding formula would have allowed her to essentially keep receiving the equivalent of a middle-class income through retirement. So she bought a house in nearby Jamison, Pennsylvania, which she's still paying off while putting a kid through college. Now 56, she's risen to become Lincoln High's special ed program coordinator, making $82,000 a year. But that retirement promise? Potentially dashed with Pennsylvania's Governor Tom Corbett on a mission to roll all new public employees into a 401k plans and tweak the formula such that the current defined benefit pensions pay out less. We're so afraid, Jamison says. We're not getting people to fill our vacancies now because of the uncertainty. We have so many young people and they're worried. Is this a place where they should work?
Amazing, huh? It says, here's what happened in between. When the pension system's invested portfolio group loaded in the go-go 1990s, the state increased benefit levels without increasing the amount either employees or the government paid into the fund. After those investments collapsed, the accounts were drained, increased the contribution necessary every year just to keep the fund solvent. If you just look at the steeply climbing trajectory of Pennsylvania's pension costs, it does appear that some sort of drastic action is necessary. And with all other budgets squeezed to the bone, perhaps public employees should be asked to pay for the miscalculation of politicians' past. And it's pretty tragic. it's pretty tragic if you look at this thing. But this graph. But is there another way? It's easy to cast about for other big pots of money to raid when these kind of shortfalls arise, no politician wants to raise taxes. There is, however, the big expense that tends to get overlooked. The tax breaks start already hand out to corporations on the theory that they won't stick around without them. In Pennsylvania, they amount to about $3.9 billion a year, several times the $1.4 billion that the state needs to contribute in order to make good on their pension obligations. That means companies all around Lincoln High avoid taxes through offshore bank accounts, stashing income monies in other states because of failure to adopt combined reporting, and locating a low-tax opportunity zone and taking advantage of credits for research and development, while kids go without prom and after-school programs because the money isn't there to fund them. And it's not just Pennsylvania. A new report out today from the search group Good Jobs First, which receives some funding from labor unions, finds that the annual cost of tax breaks and corporate subsidies often exceeds even the most out-of-control pension loads. And an examination of 10 states with some of the hottest battles over retirement plans for public employees, it calculated that they spend an average of 51% more to help out corporations than they do keeping up with the contributions to pension systems. And there's a chart here on how much it is. It's absolutely ridiculous.
And here are some of the states that are in trouble there.
Yeah, California, Colorado,
Florida, Arizona,
yeah,
Illinois,
Louisiana, Michigan,
Missouri,
Oklahoma, and
Pennsylvania.
You know, huge benefits. Pension problems. According to the report, the worst is Louisiana, which has a reputation for handing out gigantic tax breaks in the name of economic development. For example, $1.7 billion for a natural gas liquefaction plant in 2010. For example, $227 million every year to attract motion picture filming, and $473 million in preferential treatment for S Corporation. Good Jobs first calculated the total at $1.8 billion annually. At the same time, Governor Bobby Jindal is also trying to push new state employees into cash balance plans in an effort to lighten the annual pension load to just $350 million. God, what a prick.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the guy who's running for president.
Is he running again?
I don't know.
He already tried.
Good Jobs First, which has a history of going after corporate subsidies and a financial incentive to avoid to advocate for retirees, does say that all tax breaks are bad or should eliminate in order to make good on pension obligations. And these days, governments often feel as if they have no choice but to compete for business when companies, film studios, and even non-profits and universities essentially hold nationwide auctions for the best incentive packages. It's a collective action problem. If you don't play the game, you're toast. Also, there's another wrinkle in Good Jobs First accounting of pension costs. Sanford School of Business Finance professor Joshua Ra, a pension expert who reviewed the study, says they probably lowballed the calculation by using a too high discount rate. On average, such pension investment funds have performed so poorly, he found, that states need to be paying 2.5 times what they are now in order to fully fund them. They would make Good Job First comparisons with corporate welfare a little less striking. Right? This thing goes on a little bit more, but I think it's important to note that the worst case scenario is that I'll be working until I'm 85, writes this person, instead of being able to live decently like I expected to live, she says. For Louise Jordan, a tax break for a corporation that may or may not do business in the state because of it doesn't compare to the comfortable retirement she was promised.
You just read that.
Yeah, no, I didn't. Okay.
You read that.
Well, I did, but I'm going to go further. I agree we have to lure companies to employ our people, but at the same time, aren't they responsible for a promise that they made to fund the pensions of other members of their state? And of course they are. And it's pretty sad what's happening there, folks. You know, these public pensions are going to get
down the toilet.
They're going to be clobbered. So anyway, well, we got a little time. I got some presentations for you tonight that I wanted to make, and we're going to do that right now. But the first one I want to do is present the
Trans-Pacific
Partnership. This is pretty frightening.
We need to listen to this, folks. It's very important that we be informed
and
not be fooled by it.
High treason, Obama's secret meeting. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So here you go.
RTTV. You need to know this. The Obama administration is preparing to sell America out to a handful of private corporations. Well, more than a handful, but anyhow, that's because right now President Obama is preparing to push through the largest trade deal in human history, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or as it's more commonly known, the TPP. If approved, the TPP would create a whole new set of rules regulating the economies of 12 countries, the red countries seen here, on four different continents bordering the Pacific Ocean. These rules cover everything from pharmaceuticals to digital copyright law and could permanently change the way everyday Americans and people all over the world interact with the global economy. So if you think the Obama administration, you would think, as a result of this, that the Obama administration would want to keep the public as up-to-date as possible on such a big trade deal, right? Wrong. The United States has negotiated the TPP almost entirely in secret with the help of about 600 private corporations. Most of what we know about it actually comes from leaked documents, and those documents paint a pretty scary picture. Now, thanks to WikiLeaks, we have an even better idea of just how dangerous the TPP really is. Earlier today, WikiLeaks released a full draft of the treaty's intellectual property rights chapter. The 95-page document proves what many people have long suspected, that the TPP isn't so much a free trade deal as it is a giant giveaway to monster transnational corporations. According to WikiLeaks, the TPP would allow private foreign corporations to sue countries over regulations that those corporations don't like. It would allow them to expand the monopoly powers of pharmaceutical patents. And it would also give corporations the go-ahead to start blocking websites accused of violating copyright law. The documents also show that the Obama administration, on behalf of the United States, has been pushing for some of the TPP's harshest intellectual property laws. To put it bluntly, the TPP would sacrifice national sovereignty, public health, and internet freedom, all in the name of helping private corporations keep their CEOs' wallets fat and their shareholders happy. That's why the TPP is so much more dangerous than normal trade deals like NAFTA or CAFTA. Not only does it reward companies that send jobs overseas and gut regulations that keep big businesses in check, it also increases corporate control over pretty much every part of how you and I interact with the world and makes it near impossible for countries to fight back against giant corporations. As Julian Assange said about the leaked documents, if instituted, the TPP's intellectual property regime would trample over individual rights and free expression, as well as ride roughshod over the intellectual and creative commons. If you read, write, publish, think, listen, dance, sing, or invent, if you farm or consume food, if you're ill now or one day might be ill, the TPP has you in its crosshairs. In other words, it puts the rights of profit-driven businesses over the rights of human beings and the governments that we form to protect ourselves. No wonder, then, that the Obama administration doesn't even want Congress to take a closer look at the TPP. To push the U.S. into the proposed treaty as soon as possible, the president is trying to use a special legislative trick called fast-tracking that would prevent lawmakers from making any amendments to the TPP. Instead, the treaty would be sent right to the floor, where it would only have to pass a simple majority vote. Sounds like a done deal, right? Well, not so fast. A growing number of bipartisan lawmakers, including people as far away from each other on the political spectrum as Michelle Bachmann and John Lewis, are banding together to fight back against the president's TPP plan. They're calling for an open debate on the treaty and have asked the Obama administration to hold back on pushing for fast-track powers. So, will they succeed? And what's the deeper story here? For more on this, I'm joined now by Mike Papantonio, attorney and host of Ring of Fire Radio, Ring of Fire Television. Pap, welcome back.
Tom, how are you?
Just great. Hey, as I just mentioned, there's growing congressional opposition to both the TPP and President Obama's decision to try to reauthorize Fast Track to pass this thing, which a power that he doesn't have right now. It expired in 2008, as I recall. Do you think today's WikiLeaks revelations are going to help, hurt? What effect are they going to have on all this?
They are extremely important because what the American public sees now, and this is going to take the same shape that we saw with Syria, with Larry Summers, with the pipeline, XL pipeline. You're going to see so much anger about this once people understand what has been happening to them behind closed doors. It's so secretive, as a matter of fact, that even the people working on it had to sign a classified information non-disclosure agreement, and that's how he's kept it secret. But real problematic is, why would a president that runs on the idea of being the people's candidate want to keep this so quiet when it puts so many people out of jobs and is such a huge threat to every facet of the American public. Why would he want to keep that secret? That's the big question. I think I know the answer.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm guessing for you that's not a rhetorical question. What do you think the answer is?
Well, I think it all comes down to the fact that we saw the same thing happen with Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton was surrounded by the Robert Rubin types, by the Penny Pritzker types, by the Wall Street types. That's where Bill Clinton's money came from. We have ignored the fact that Obama came up the same way. It's simply a continuation of what we saw with the Bill Clinton administration, with NAFTA and CAFTA. Now he has made promises. There's nothing else you can read into this. He's made promises. He had to make promises in order to get elected, to get all that money from Wall Street, and now it's payback time. Wall Street had the good sense to understand there's no way that anybody with a brain and a gag reflex could ever put up with this type of legislation or this type of treaty, so he kept it quiet, intentionally tried to hide it from the American public and the press.
I think one of the most interesting parts of this is, well, actually, the only part that we really know right now is this intellectual property part. But that's, you know, both damning and fascinating. I'm curious your thoughts about the revelation, probably the biggest revelation in this, was that it's the United States who's pushing hardest for this. It seems to me like I'm seeing the hand of Microsoft and Disney and Sony and whatnot behind this, but maybe the pharmaceutical companies? I mean, that's an area that
big time.
Super specialized in. Your thoughts?
Big time. Well, what has happened is Exxon, DuPont, Dow Chemical, Eli Lilly, Merck, all the big companies have already had great success just gaming the system and taking away sovereignty by way of NAFTA. NAFTA is very weak where it comes to for a foreign entity's right to come in and change a sovereign law. TPP puts NAFTA on steroids, but already we've seen the oil companies force people in Canada that said, you know, we don't want you drilling in our backyard. They've been forced, they've been sued, and the legislation that prevents that that drilling has been thrown to the side. Same way with fracking. Same way with pricing of pharmaceuticals. This is a complete takeover of what we hold so dearly, and that's the right for us to be able to govern ourselves, Tom. And really, this is the last stage, if this were to succeed, this is the last stage of making the United States into something akin to Saipan in this sense. It creates what we call job scarcity. If you have 20 people that are applying for the same job, the employer is able to say, no, we're not going to honor OSHA. We're not going to honor regulations. We're not going to pay a minimum wage. We're not going to allow for unionization. And all of a sudden, the person right behind that guy applying for the job says, well, I'll take the job. Look. When you take regulations away, when you let corporations get involved in interfering with sovereign regulations and sovereign laws, it always works to the benefit of the corporation. That's the gotcha. That's the gotcha part of this whole thing. That's where it's headed. Obama knows it. He's not an idiot. He simply is owned and operated by Wall Street. And it's hard to admit it, but that's the guy we elected, and now we're seeing it. This is a telltale of what this man really is all about. Why else would he keep it a secret?
What's the word on when this thing is going to drop?
Well, I think what at this point it's going to be slowed down dramatically. That what's going to happen is they have to get this through with Obama. He has to be the guy, because there's a good possibility that Hillary won't be able to do it. Hillary's going to be running for cover as she sees this pendulum swing and progressives get more and more involved with saying, you know, damn it, we're tired of centrist politics. We're tired of Democrats acting like damn Republicans. And Hillary, you better not stand behind this. So Obama is the last chance they have. They're going to put full tilt, full speed behind this thing every way they can. And the only thing that's going to stop it, Sam, the only thing that's going to stop is Tom, is people like you and me and Sam, who I was talking about this radio show with me, and Bobby Kennedy, and the people that are out in the media. That is not mainstream media, but the citizens' media. They're going to stop this. This is where the real anger is going to come in.
Yeah, 30 seconds, Pap. There's absolute radio silence in the corporate media on this. Why?
Oh, They want it. Listen, this is great for corporate media. It sells more goods. Anytime you sell more goods, advertisers are happy, and the guys on the 50th floor with that MBA that could not care less about the future of this country, they make more bonus money.
Yeah, incredible. Mike Papantonio, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And I think your analysis is...
So there you go,
pretty
folks.
Scary.
Yeah, pretty damn scary. And I'm going to break away here from that and go to a quick play a tune.
And then you can get up that last video.
This last video is from Edward Snowden on German TV, banned in the U.S. actually, but we've got a copy of it, and I'm going to play it. But let me just play a quick little blues break here, and we'll be back right after. Okay, link the YouTube thing to the website, and that should be on. I'm hoping. I just went through the whole thing, so click play. There we go.
Mr. Snowden, did you sleep well the last couple of nights? Because I was reading that you asked for a kind of police protection. Are there any threats?
There are significant threats, but I sleep very well. There was an article that came out in an online outlet called BuzzFeed, where they interviewed officials from the Pentagon, from the National Security Agency, and they gave them anonymity to be able to say what they wanted. And what they told the reporter was that they wanted to murder me. These individuals, and these are acting government officials, they said they would be happy, they would love to put a bullet in my head, to poison me as I was returning from the grocery store, and have me die in the shower.
Unfortunately, you're still alive with us.
Right, but I'm still alive, and I don't lose sleep. because I've done what I feel I needed to do. It was the right thing to do, and I'm not going to be afraid.
The greatest fear I have, and I quote you, regarding these disclosures, is nothing will change. That was one of your greatest concerns at the time. But in the meantime, there is a vivid discussion about the situation with the NSA, not only in America, but also in Germany and in Brazil. And President Obama was forced to go public and to justify what the NSA was doing on legal grounds.
What we saw initially in response to the revelations was sort of a circling of the wagons of government around the National Security Agency. Instead of circling around the public and protecting their rights, the political class circled around the security state and protected their rights. What's interesting is, though that was the initial response, since then, we've seen a softening. We've seen the president acknowledge that when he first said, we've drawn the right balance, there are no abuses. We've seen him and his officials admit that there have been abuses. There have been thousands of violations of the National Security Agency and other agencies' authorities every single year.
Is the speech of Obama recently the beginning of a serious regulation?
It was clear from the president's speech that he wanted to make minor changes to preserve authorities that we don't need. The president created a review board from officials that were personal friends, from national security insiders, former deputy of the CIA, people who had every incentive to be soft on these programs and to see them in the best possible light. But what they found was that these programs have no value. They've never stopped a terrorist attack in the United States. And they have marginal utility at best for other things. The only thing that the Section 215 phone metadata program, actually it's a broader metadata program, a bulk collection means mass surveillance program, was in stopping it or detecting an $8,500 wire transfer from a cab driver in California. And it's this kind of review where insiders go, we don't need these programs. These programs don't make us safe. They take a tremendous amount of resources to run, and they offer us no value. They go, we can modify these. The National Security Agency operates under the president's executive authority alone. He can end or modify or direct a change in their policies at any time.
For the first time, President Obama did concede that the NSA collects and stores trillions of data.
Every time you pick up the phone, dial a number, write an email, make a purchase, travel on the bus carrying a cell phone, swipe a card somewhere, you leave a trace. And the government has decided that it's a good idea to collect it all, everything, even if you've never been suspected of any crime. Traditionally, the government would identify a suspect. They would go to a judge. They would say, we suspect he's committed this crime. They would get a warrant, and then they would be able to use the totality of their powers in pursuit of the investigation. Nowadays, what we see is they want to apply the totality of their powers in advance, prior to an investigation.
You started this debate. Edward Snowden is, in the meantime, a household name for the whistleblower in the age of the Internet. You were working till last summer for the NSA, and during this time you collected secretly thousands of confidential documents. What was the decisive moment, or was there a long period of time or something happening? Why did you do this?
I would say sort of the breaking point is seeing the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, directly lie under oath to Congress. There's no saving an intelligence community that believes it can lie to the public and the legislators who need to be able to trust it and regulate its actions. Seeing that really meant for me there was no going back. Beyond that, it was the creeping realization that no one else was going to do this. The public had a right to know about these programs. The public had a right to know that which the government is doing.
Oh, boy. Well, folks, that somebody doesn't like what we are attempting to do here.
interesting, huh?
That was very interesting. We've been, you can't kill us, you bastard. But, you're making it difficult for us to broadcast. But, just so you know that the L.A. Steel Show is being censored, all right? And
but you can go and get that
yes, you can.
Own computer.
You can. I happen to be
go to YouTube.
It's on YouTube. It's Edward Snowden interview. But you can do that. And Edward Snowden interview, Sherman interview. And I'm going back to get it. But say, you son of a bitches who think you can beat me, you can't.
It's out there already.
Eric Snowden is being has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, and folks, we keep going. I mean, last week we got zapped 4 or 5 times during the show, and it's just unbelievable what somebody these people are so afraid of us. They're so afraid, I don't understand. I can't understand, really, why they are so afraid of us. But they are. So this word to get out, for the, this interview was banned in the United States. And I was able to get it. I found out about it on the internet, on my Facebook. And, of course, somebody just beat me to it, that's okay, folks. We still got 40 minutes, and I'm going back to get it. And, goddamn the hackers and the NSA who don't want it. That's what we're on here.
What's important you understand what's happened to us.
Yeah.
And what's continually happening to us.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
And it's happening to you and to me. I want to understand it. To all of us.
Sure. And, you got to do this. You have to. You have to do this. It's just, you got to do it. We have to do it. We have to make people understand, and fight. And that's all we're here for, folks. And it's coming back. It's coming back. We're back on the page.
And if we can really play it, you have to go to YouTube and put in William Snowden, and you'll get
it. Well, it's nextnewsnetwork.com is where you can find it. All right, and I'm going back to it, and I'm going to bring you back to where we left off, which was about 3 or 4 into it. And, we'll go from there.
An intelligence community that believes it can lie to the public and the legislators who need to be able to trust it and regulate its action. Seeing that really meant for me there was no going back. Beyond that, it was the creeping realization that no one else was going to do this. The public had a right to know about these programs. The public had a right to know that which the government is doing in its name and that which the government is doing against the public. But neither of these things we were allowed to discuss, we were allowed to know. Even the wider body of our elected representatives were prohibited from knowing or discussing these programs, and that's a dangerous thing. The only review we had was from a secret court, the FISA court, which is a sort of rubber stamp authority. When you are on the inside, when you go into work every day, when you go into work every day, when you sit down at the desk and you realize the power you have, you can wiretap the President of the United States. You can wiretap the federal judge. And if you do it carefully, no one will ever know, because the only way the NSA discovers abuses are from self-reporting.
We are not talking only of the NSA as far as this is concerned. There is a multilateral agreement for cooperation among the services. And this alliance of intelligence operations is known as the Five Eyes. What agencies and countries belong to this alliance, and what is its purpose?
The Five Eyes Alliance is sort of an artifact of the post-World War II era, where the Anglophone countries of the major powers banded together to sort of cooperate and share the costs of intelligence gathering infrastructure. So we have the UK's GCHQ, we have the US NSA, we have Canada's CSEC, we have the Australian Signals Intelligence Directorate, and we have New Zealand's DSD. What the result of this was over decades and decades was sort of a supranational intelligence organization that doesn't answer to the laws of its own country.
In many countries, as in America too, the agencies like the NSA are not allowed to spy within their own borders on their own people. So the Brits, for example, they can spy on everybody but the Brits. But the NSA can conduct surveillance in England. So at the very end, they could exchange their data and it would be, they would be strictly following the law.
If you asked the governments about this directly, they would deny it and point to policy agreements between the members of the Five Eyes, saying that they won't spy on each other's citizens. But there are a couple key points there. One is that the way they define spying is not the collection of data. The GCHQ is collecting an incredible amount of data on British citizens, just as the National Security Agency is gathering an enormous amount of data on U.S. citizens. What they're saying is that they will not then target people within that data. They won't look for UK citizens or British citizens. In addition, the policy agreements between them that say British won't target U.S. citizens, U.S. won't target British citizens, are not legally binding. The actual memorandums of agreement state specifically on that, that they're not intended to put a legal restriction on any government. They're policy agreements that can be deviated from or broken at any time. So if they want to spy on a British citizen, they can spy on a British citizen. And then they can even share that data with the British government that is itself forbidden from spying on UK citizens. So there is a sort of a trading dynamic there, but it's not open. It's more of a nudge and a wink. And beyond that, the key is to remember that the surveillance and the abuse doesn't occur when people look at the data. It occurs when people gather the data in the first place.
How narrow is the cooperation of the German Secret Service, BND, with the NSA and the Five Eyes?
I would describe it as intimate. As a matter of fact, the first way I described it in our written interview was that the German services and the U.S. services are in bed together. They not only share information, the reporting, the results from intelligence, but they actually share the tools and the infrastructure. They work together against joint targets and services. And there's a lot of danger in this. One of the major programs that faces abuse in the National Security Agency is what's called XKeyscore. It's a front-end search engine that allows them to look through all of the records they collect through worldwide every day.
What could you do if you would sit, so to speak, on their blaze with this kind of instrument?
You could read anyone's email in the world. Anybody you've got an email address for, any website you can watch traffic to and from it, any computer that an individual sits at, you can watch it, any laptop that you're tracking, you can follow it as it moves from place to place throughout the world. It's a one-stop shop for access to the NSA's information. And what's more, you can tag individuals using XKeyscore, where, let's say I saw you once, and I thought what you were doing was interesting, or you just have access that's interesting to me. Let's say you work at a major German corporation, and I want access to that network. I can track your username on a website, on a forum somewhere. I can track your real name. I can track associations with your friends. And I can build what's called a fingerprint, which is network activity unique to you, which means anywhere you go in the world, anywhere you try to sort of hide your online presence, hide your identity, the NSA can find you. And anyone who's allowed to use this or who the NSA shares the software with can do the same thing. Germany is one of the countries that has access to XKeyscore.
It sounds rather frightening. The question is, does the BND deliver data of the Germans to the NSA?
Whether the BND does it directly or knowingly, the NSA gets German data. Whether it's provided, I can't speak to until it's been reported because it would be classified, and I prefer that journalists must make the distinctions and the decisions about what is public interest and what should be published. However, it's no secret that every country in the world has the data of their citizens in the NSA. Millions and millions and millions of data connections from Germans going about their daily lives, talking on their cell phones, sending SMS messages, visiting websites, buying things online. All of this ends up at the NSA. And it's reasonable to suspect that the BND may be aware of it in some capacity. Now, whether or not they actively provide the information, I should not say.
The BND basically argues, if we do this, we do this accidentally, actually, and our filter didn't work.
Right. So the kind of things that they're discussing there are two things. They're talking about filtering of ingest, which means when the NSA puts a secret server in a German telecommunications provider, or they hack a German router and they divert the traffic in a manner that lets them search through things, they're saying, if I see what I think is a German talking to another German, I'll drop it. But how do you know? You could say, well, these people are speaking the German language. This IP address seems to be from a German company to another German company, but that's not accurate, and they wouldn't dump all of that traffic because they'll get people who are targets of interest, who are actively in Germany using German communications. So realistically what's happening is when they say there's no spying on Germans, they don't mean that German data isn't being gathered. They don't mean that records aren't being taken or stolen. What they mean is that they're not intentionally searching for German citizens. And that's sort of a fingers crossed behind the back promise. It's not reliable.
What's about other European countries like Norway and Sweden, for example, because we have a lot of, I think, underwater cables going through the Baltic Sea?
So this is sort of an expansion of the same idea. If the NSA isn't collecting information on German citizens in Germany, are they as soon as it leaves German borders? And the answer is yes. Any single communication that transits the Internet, the NSA may intercept at multiple points. They might see it in Germany. They might see it in Sweden. They might see it in Norway or Finland. They might see it in Britain, and they might see it in the United States. Any single one of these places that a German communication crosses, it'll be ingested and added to the database.
So let's come to our southern European neighbors then. What's about Italy? What's about France? What's about Spain?
it's the same deal worldwide.
Does the NSA spy on Siemens, on Mercedes, on other successful German companies, for example, to prevail, to have the advantage of knowing what is going on in the scientific and the economic world?
I don't want to preempt the editorial decisions of journalists.
Okay.
But what I will say is there's no question that the U.S. is engaged in economic spying. If there's information at Siemens that they think would be beneficial to the national interests, not the national security of the United States, they'll go after that information and they'll take it.
There is this old saying, you do whatever you can do. So the NSA is doing whatever is technically possible.
This is something that the president touched on last year, where he said just because we can do something, and this was in relation to tapping Angela Merkel's phone, just because we can do something doesn't mean that we should. And that's exactly what's happened. The technological capabilities that have been provided because of sort of weak security standards in internet protocols and cellular communications networks have meant that intelligence services can create systems that see everything.
Nothing annoyed the German government more than the fact that the NSA taped the private phone of the German Chancellor Merkel over the last 10 years, obviously. Suddenly this invisible surveillance was connected with a known face and was not connected with a kind of watery, shady terrorist background. Obama now promised to stop snooping on Merkel, which raises the question, did the NSA tape already previous governments in Germany, previous chancellors, and when did they do that, and how long did they do this for?
This is a particularly difficult question for me to answer because there's information that I very strongly believe is in the public interest. However, as I've said before, I prefer for journalists to make those decisions in advance, review the material themselves, and decide whether or not the public value of this information outweighs the sort of reputational cost to the officials that ordered the surveillance. What I can say is we know Angela Merkel was monitored by the National Security Agency. The question is, how reasonable is it to assume that she is the only German official that was monitored? How reasonable is it to believe that she is the only prominent German face who the National Security Agency was watching? I would suggest it seems unreasonable that if anyone was concerned about the intentions of German leadership, that they would only watch Merkel and not her aides, not other prominent officials, not heads of ministries, or even local government officials.
How does a young man from Elizabeth City in North Carolina, 30 years old, get in such a position in such a sensitive area?
That's a very difficult question to answer. In general, I would say it highlights the dangers of privatizing government functions. I worked previously as an actual staff officer, a government employee for the Central Intelligence Agency, but I've also served much more frequently as a contractor in a private capacity. What that means is you have private for-profit companies doing inherently governmental work, like targeted espionage, surveillance, compromising foreign systems. And anyone who has the skills, who can convince a private company that they have the qualifications to do so, will be empowered by the government to do that. And there's very little oversight. There's very little review.
Have you been one of these classical computer kids, sitting red-eyed during the nights in the age of 12, 15, and your father was knocking on your door and saying, switch off the light, it's too late now. Did you get your computer skills from that side, or how did it work? When did you get your computer skills?
Right. I definitely have had a deep informal education in computers and electronic technology. They've always been fascinating and interesting to me. The characterization of having your parents telling you to go to bed, I would say, is fair.
If one looks to the little public data of your life, one discovers that you obviously wanted to join in May 2004 the Special Forces to fight in Iraq. What did motivate you at the time? You know, Special Forces, looking at you in the very moment, means grim fighting, and it means probably killing. And did you ever get to Iraq?
No, I didn't get to Iraq. One of the interesting things about these special forces are that they're not actually intended for direct combat. They're what's referred to as a force multiplier. They're inserted behind enemy lines. It's a squad that has a number of different specialties in it, and they teach and enable the local population to resist or to support U.S. forces in a way that allows the local population a chance to help determine their own destiny. And I felt that was an inherently noble thing at the time. In hindsight, some of the reasons that we went into Iraq were not well-founding, and I think did a disservice to everyone involved.
What happened to your adventure then? Did you go to stay long with them, or what happened to you?
No, I broke my legs when I was in training and was discharged.
So it was a short adventure. In 2007, the CIA stationed you with a diplomatic cover in Geneva in Switzerland. Why did you join the CIA, by the way?
I don't think I can actually answer that one.
Okay, if it's what you have been doing there, forget it, but why did you join the CIA?
In many ways, I think it's a continuation of trying to do everything I could to prosecute the public good in the most effective way. And it's in line with the rest of my government service, where I tried to use my technical skills in the most difficult positions I could find in the world, and the CIA offered that.
You see, look back, Special Forces, CIA, NSA, It's not actually the description of a human rights activist or somebody who becomes a whistleblower after this. What happens to you?
I think it tells a story, and that's no matter how deeply an individual is embedded in the government, no matter how faithful to the government they are, no matter how strongly they believe in the causes of their government, as I did during the Iraq War, people can learn, people can discover the line between appropriate government behavior and actual wrongdoing. And I think it became clear to me that that line had been crossed.
You worked for the NSA through a private contractor with the name Booth Allen Hamilton, one of the big ones in the business. What is the advantage for the U.S. government or the CIA to work through a private contractor to outsource a central government function?
Contracting culture of the national security community in the United States is a complex topic. It's driven by a number of interests between primarily limiting the number of direct government employees, at the same time as keeping lobbying groups in Congress, typically from very well-funded businesses, such as Booz Allen Hamilton. The problem there is you end up in a situation where government policies are being influenced by private corporations who have interests that are completely divorced from the public good in mind. The result of that is what we saw at Booz Allen Hamilton, where you have private individuals who have access to what the government alleges were millions and millions of records that they could walk out the door with at any time with no accountability, no oversight, no auditing. The government didn't even know they were gone.
At the very end, you ended up in Russia. Many of the intelligence community suspect you made a deal, classified material for asylum here in Russia.
The chief of the task force investigating me, as recently as December, said that their investigation had turned up no evidence or indications at all that I had any outside help or contact or had made a deal of any kind to accomplish my mission. I worked alone. I didn't need anybody's help. I don't have any ties to foreign governments. I'm not a spy for Russia or China or any other country for that matter. If I'm a traitor, who did I betray? I gave all of my information to the American public, to American journalists who are reporting on American issues. If they see that as treason, I think people really need to consider who do they think they're working for. The public is supposed to be their boss, not their enemy. Beyond that, as far as my personal safety, I'll never be fully safe until these systems have changed.
After your revelations, none of the European countries really offered you asylum. Where did you apply in Europe for asylum?
I can't remember the list of countries with any specificity because there were many of them. But France, Germany were definitely in there, as was the UK. A number of European countries, all of whom, unfortunately, felt that doing the right thing was less important than supporting U.S. political concerns.
One reaction to the NSA snooping is in the very moment that countries like Germany are thinking to create national internets, an attempt to force internet companies to keep their data in their own country. Does this work?
It's not going to stop the NSA, let's put it that way. The NSA goes where the data is. If the NSA can pull text messages out of telecommunication networks in China, they can probably manage to get Facebook messages out of Germany. Ultimately, the solution to that is not to try to stick everything in a walled garden, although that does raise the level of sophistication and complexity of taking the information. It's also much better simply to secure the information internationally against everyone rather than playing let's move the data. Moving the data isn't fixing the problem. Securing the data is the problem.
President Obama, in the very moment, obviously doesn't care too much about the message of the League. And together with the NSA, they do care very much more about catching the messenger in that context. Obama asked the Russian president several times to extradite you, but did not. It looks that you will stay till the rest of your life probably in Russia. How do you feel about Russia in that context? And is there a solution to this problem?
I think it's becoming increasingly clear that these leaks didn't cause harm. In fact, they served the public good. Because of that, I think it'll be very difficult to maintain sort of an ongoing campaign of persecution against someone who the public agrees serves the public interest.
The New York Times wrote a very long comment and demanded clemency for you. The headline, Edward Snowden whistleblower, and I quote from that. The public learned in great detail how the agency has extended its mandate and abused its authority, and the New York Times closes. President Obama should tell his aides to begin finding a way to end Mr. Snowden's vilification and give him an incentive to return home. Did you get a call in between from the White House?
I've never received a call from the White House, and I'm not waiting by the phone. But I would welcome the opportunity to talk about how we can bring this to a conclusion that serves the interests of all parties. I think it's clear there are times where what is lawful is distinct from what is rightful. There are times throughout history, and it doesn't take long for either an American or a German to think about times in the history of their country where the law provided the government to do things which were not right.
President Obama obviously is, in the very moment, not quite convinced of that, because he said to you are charged with three felonies. And I quote, if you, Edward Snowden, believe in what you did, you should go back to America, appear before the court with a lawyer and make your case. Is this the solution?
It's interesting because he mentions three felonies. What he doesn't say is that the crimes that he's charged me with are crimes that don't allow me to make my case. They don't allow me to defend myself in an open court to the public and convince a jury that what I did was to their benefit. The Espionage Act was never intended, it's from 1918, it was never intended to prosecute journalistic sources, people who are informing the newspapers about information that's of public interest. It was intended for people who are selling documents in secret to foreign governments, who are bombing bridges, who are sabotaging communications, not people who are serving the public good. So it's, I would say, illustrative that the president would choose to say someone should face the music when he knows the music is a show trial.
Edward Snowden, thank you very much for the interview.
Thank you.
Yeah. Wir sind eins, ARD.
Okay, that's the end of that show, and I want to thank everybody for joining me, and talk to you tomorrow, maybe. Have a good night.